Unruffled Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday at 10 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. And I'm your host tonight, Rabbi Laura Sheinkoff, along with Jacob Reiner, working the boards. Hi, Jacob. Are you there? You're working still tonight.
Yes, I am. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Our guest this evening is someone who I've known for many, many years, but I wanted to just start by giving you a quote. Charles Dickens, at the beginning of David Copperfield, says, "Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life or whether that station will be held by anyone else, these pages must show." I really can't think of another person who embodies this statement more than my guest, Leah Lax, who is here, and who is really the hero of her own life, and also shared it in a way that was heroic. So I think her story was heroic to live and heroic to write. Her journey went from a fairly secular Jewish home in Dallas to ultra-Orthodox Hasidic world. She was a Lubavitcher Hasidic woman. And spent 30 years married, having 7 children, being very involved in the community. And eventually she came out. And just to describe that world, I think, a little bit so you can understand the basis of her new memoir, she was lived in a world that had no microwave, no television, no driving on the Sabbath, very strict rules about marriage, and no birth control. Certainly. So her new memoir is Uncovered, and it is her story. She's written a lot of other things. She is the author of The Mikvah Project, and she is also the author, the libretto for Houston Grand Opera's original opera called The Refuge. Sure Fiction has won prizes, 2001 Moment Magazine Prize for Short Story, and this book has really caught on and has been talked about by people as huge as Gloria Steinem. That is so cool. I just say, that's so cool. It's been listed in as a top 10 book list, and she's been traveling around the country reading and speaking about her work, and we're so happy that she has found some time for us. Thank you. You're here.
Thank you.
What's really, really fortunate is that you not only have a really compelling story to tell, but you're also a writer. So you can tell that story with an unusual amount of depth, I think, and also just a sense of bigger picture that really brings this to life in a way that I don't think everyone could tell that way. So I know you grew up in Dallas. You went to UT. Mm-hmm. You're also a graduate of U of H's creative writing program, very prestigious. And all the while, you lived most of your adult life in the Lubavitcher Hasidic community right here in Houston, which most Houstonians would probably not even recognize that world. And so before we really launch into your story, or a couple of vignettes about your story, I just wondered if you could sort of fill people in on the context of that community and how difficult, so they can appreciate, I guess, how difficult your path was.
I can do that, but I want to start with a larger American context, okay? Mm-hmm. Because I was a child of 60s liberal parents, a public school kid, a Dallas kid. I went to UT because that's where we all went. And we're talking early 70s at this point. It's not just that the Jewish Orthodox Student Union or the student organization was burgeoning. So was the Catholic Student Union. So was the Baptist and the Methodist. And the Muslim kids were demonstrating on campus, yelling against the Shah. We were all moving to the right. Hmm. We were kids. This was our adolescent rebellion. We were rebelling against what we saw as our parent, thought of as our parents' fungible morality, and mm-hmm. we were going to be the grown-ups.
Yeah.
We were going to take our right-wing rebellion out into the world, and we did. We're living with it right now.
Mm-hmm.
I was part of that. The thing is, though, that I moved into this community that was so far right, and I grew up there because I joined them at 16, that
right.
It formed my adulthood,
right.
And they were the parameters. They were the horizon. I couldn't see past it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no vocabulary for so much, from anything from doubts in faith, mm-hmm. or even admitting my exhaustion in a life that has all kinds of stringencies for women,
right.
You know, endless children, enormous amount of labor in the home because, for example, with strict controls over our food, lots of rules are involved in the kosher rules in the ultra-Orthodox.
Right.
It meant preparing all that food. My life was in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I didn't have a vocabulary for questioning. I also want to, and I certainly didn't have any vocabulary for those erotic lesbian dreams
that
I try not to think about.
Until you read Adrienne Rich, though. I love the fact that you describe Adrienne's poetry as part of your awakening, because I think it, just because I'm a nerd probably too, but you know, you were so isolated, but somehow at least a book found you, or you found it. So I'm wondering if, I know you're going to share a little snippet from the book, but we had been talking before about sort of secrecy, and I think you described very well that this world really didn't prepare you to be able to understand even who you were, as you said, right? And it led to a lot of secrecy, which I'm sure poisoned, you know, was difficult to come from.
Look, and by the way, I want to correct you on one thing. We definitely had microwaves.
You know what I mean? Did you cook your challah in the microwave?
No.
You're better than me.
Okay, now I need that recipe.
You can't do it on Shabbos. You can't use the microwave.
Look, that world fulfilled many things for me at a young age, and there was a lot of beauty there.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that I loved, and I want to be careful not to paint it with a broad brush.
Right.
I think any community that is unlike our broader secular American community, which is heterogeneous. I mean, our heterogeneous, or however you pronounce it, our criteria for being here is simply to be an individual. What we bring to the table is as much of ourselves as possible. It's what we have to offer.
Right. Yeah. I think that is an important thing to say.
But in a community like that, it's homogeneous. We were wrapped around a single idea. So we existed for that idea. The community existed for that idea.
Right.
If we're in a religious community, if you say that you're different, it's a threat to the whole.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So we got knocked, you know, we could get slammed for that. It's just different. It's a different society. It's a different dynamic. But, okay, we can get back to the story.
Yeah, you write about it so beautifully. So I'm wondering if you could share with us, you know, some of the way you describe that. Because you didn't write a book about sociology, or you wrote a memoir. You wrote a piece of literature. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so share with us, you know, how this story came through that prism.
Right. So I met the, you know, I mentioned the campus as a kid, and I wound up in an arranged marriage. And I'm talking about the rabbi saying, you know, this guy's interested in you, and that means he wants to marry you automatically. And at that point, I was already deeply involved in the religion, so we kind of saw ourselves as soldiers of God. I mean, we're proud of our compliance. It was a defiant kind of compliance, because we all knew our parents would hate it. Mm-hmm. And he proposed on the first date.
Wow.
It was a formality. And then the book opens with my wedding, and the wedding was in my grandmother's home back in Dallas, so we're talking North Dallas society, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when all these wannabe young Hasidim and actual Hasidim showed up at the wedding and then kind of took it over too, to my grandparents and my mother too, really. It was kind of like, well, the best comparison I could make would be hillbilly relatives showing up uninvited to your nouveau riche affair. That's kind of what it was like.
Right.
But we embarked on, you know, instead of being born into this religion, it was kind of like we were following a bulleted how-to list. But we did our best, and eventually, after graduating, we moved down to Houston and joined a new fledgling Hasidic community that still is quite flourishing here in Houston. All my children were born there. It's in the Fondren area in southwest Houston.
Right. And so during that time, your main job was raising kids, as you said.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And I want to say something that the community I found not something I was aware of as a teenager, but looking back, mm-hmm. oh my God, there's a huge homoerotic quality.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I mean, with the men separate from the women, the men dance arm in arm, and they even kiss each other. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're the older ones used to, and
mm-hmm.
They're very intimate with one another, like mm-hmm. in these Fabrengans, these late nights, you know, song fests where they kind mm-hmm. of bare their souls to God. And the women were hovering on the side, and we mm-hmm. were constantly helping each other in mm-hmm. each other's, you know, kind of personal space, because we all needed that support.
Right.
So it's a very, very heavy workload for women, or for anybody raising a big family.
And how did your, I know that these kinds of transitions in life have a lot of moments. They don't happen like a bolt of lightning, but, you know, tell us about one moment that in which it was just very clear to you that something major was going to have to change.
Okay, I'm going to cut all the way deep in the book, guys.
Okay,
so you have to read the book if you want to know the story. Good.
Okay.
There were many transition moments that I tried to repress.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when I wrote this book, I said, a normal book, you've got these plot points where the character changes. And in my case, you see the changing point, and then she doesn't change because she, me, is mm-hmm. stubbornly staying on course for the sake of the children till you want to throttle her.
Right.
But then eventually the cup runs over. And in my case, after many different things happening to make me question who I was and to question my faith, after my seventh child was born, when my seventh child was born, this was the situation. My oldest was 10 years old. That meant I had seven children under the age of 10 in the home. My sixth child was 11 months old. My seventh child, newborn, was premature.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the degree, the intensity. And I'm a detail person, and I really was not going to compromise their care or their upbringing. So I was constantly running lists in my head. And to top it off, I had these dreams that caused panic attacks. So I had insomnia for years. It turned out to be a good thing, because I used to stay up late at night and write and then hide my stories. I would literally print them out, mm-hmm. delete it from the computer, and hide them under my bed.
Wow.
But that's when I had to have an outlet.
Right.
And then I became pregnant one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had ignored my feelings, my needs, my everything. I was stubborn, still fighting mom, you know, like, I got this. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And I love my kids, and I'm going to keep the structure good for them. It doesn't matter how I feel, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I became pregnant one more time. In that setup I just described, mm-hmm. the baby was, I don't know, 3 months old.
Right.
And I had trained myself very deeply to ignore that inner voice, but this time it was screaming.
Mm-hmm.
I was literally pacing around the house with this voice in my head that sounded like a stranger to me going, get it out, get it out, get it out, get it. I thought this is going to kill me. This is a cancer. This is not a child. It was like that.
Right.
And I became very, very determined to do something that, you know, every ounce of my life was had always opposed.
Right.
Everything changed.
Right.
I always thought of women who got abortions as irresponsible and profligate, you know, they indulge at will, and then they just go discard it. You know, that's what I used to think.
Right.
And then
I
went, no, those women, it's between them and God. This is an individual, personal, moral choice. And I wondered how many of them had the sense of desperation that I was feeling in that moment.
Right.
Totally changed me.
Right.
The thing is, Judaism does allow abortion in certain cases. It's not like Catholic religion. Even very Orthodox religion has some place for abortion, but it has to be life-threatening.
Right, and it has to be approved by the rabbi.
Point.
Mm-hmm.
So I confronted my husband.
Mm-hmm.
He fell apart,
mm-hmm.
first accusing me, then crying,
mm-hmm.
and I agreed. Then we went, okay, we'll ask the rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
But in my heart, for the first time ever, I knew that if he said no,
mm-hmm. you couldn't do it.
I would do it anyway.
Right.
Well, in the end, the rabbi agreed.
Wow.
But he said, never tell anyone, which is why I always tell this story. I have to. Because I'm horribly disappointed that I let to this day, that I let someone else make that decision for me.
Right.
But I changed from that point on. I said, this is my body, and therefore it's my life. And that voice, I heard it now.
Right.
I could never be the same. If that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you right now.
Wow. That it takes such courage to take a hold of yourself in a moment that's that difficult. Anyway, though, I wanted to take a break to say that we are here on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. You're listening to So What's Your Story? I'm interviewing Leah Lax, whose new memoir, Uncovered, is producing a lot of buzz. We are 89.5 in Galveston and 90.3 in Livingston. And before we go any further with Leah, which we're going to get back to her story, I wanted to break for a few announcements. We are sponsored by the Story Writers Guild of Houston. Jake, are you there? Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes, the Houston Storytellers Guild is not only our proud sponsor, but it's the best darn storytelling group in the state. Whether you're a greenhorn or a seasoned storyteller, the Guild will welcome you with open arms. They meet the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 at the Printing Museum, located at 1324 West Clay. There is plenty of parking and plenty of fun. On Wednesday, March 16th, from 7 to 9 p.m., storytelling icon Lauren Naomi will be performing a concert at the Printing Museum, and you don't want to miss that. For all the specifics, go to www.houstonstorytellers.org. And on the following night, March 17th, Dr. Hank will be hosting Dr. Naomi on the show, only on KPFT 90.1 Houston.
Thank you. Thank you. And I hope you will join us next week as well. Warren Hollerman is going to be interviewing Dr. Michael Winters about poignant stories that heal, and you don't want to miss it. You never want to miss this. So what's your story? And it promises to be a really nice show. Leah, why don't you give us a little snippet of your book? I don't know which part you're going to read right now, but I'd love to hear it.
Well, we've had some heavy, so we need some fun.
Okay, good. Excellent.
I want to start by telling you that Red Book Magazine and Good Housekeeping Magazine both listed my book, Uncovered, How I Left Hasidic Life and Finally Came Home, as a best of 2015. And Gloria Steinem actually named my book, and her approbation is on the cover. In this scene, again, late in the book, well, you know what? Let's let it speak for itself. I decide I have to go visit my mother. I don't know why, don't understand that somehow I need to go back and finally look unflinching into her mother mirror, just as I don't know why in the memories of the girl that I was and her hopes and dreams are plaguing me. I just know I'm going, and it seems necessary. The visit will be of little consequence, other than to make it clear that she's aging, and I'll never really find the mother of my childhood fantasies. The kids are spending the night with friends. I can go. As I head north toward Dallas on I-45, the sky is a vast blueness, the wide-open highway a ribbon cutting across the enormous flat middle of the state. I sail past fields of oats, sorghum, corn, herds of cattle that slowly pick up their heads to watch with liquid brown eyes, past widely separated exits for towns with names like Flatonia and Waxahachie. It's December, and that means warm sunshine coupled with cool wind, the sky, and again the sky, so inland blue it's almost painful to look at. And as I drive, topping 80, my scarf starts to slip off my head. Now I have to interject here that we were enjoined to always keep our hair covered. Nobody ever, ever saw my head, even when I was sleeping. The scarf starts to slip off my head, and I let it go. Like a discarded fig leaf, no one will see. Only God. Then I'm angry. I think my God doesn't chastise. My God's silence is a tacit embrace. But really, the fallen scarf is my gauntlet. With it, I'm challenging the God of the law, insisting he change. It's a kind of a take me as I am, but not one of submission. An hour into the drive, I need a cold drink and a bathroom. There's a filling station up ahead set up in an old house with a convenience store in it. So I exit and pull in, observing its peeled paint, its cracked oil-stained concrete. I stop beside a beat-up, mud-spattered old pickup with a man beside it. He's leaning back against the truck with one foot anchored behind him on the running board, in worn jeans and a plaid flannel shirt and old boots with mud on them, his face leathery and lined. He's smoking a cigarette pinched between thumb and forefinger, squinting his eyes at that sky. I sit there in my parked car bareheaded next to his pickup. As I touch the door handle to get out, a moment of programmed Hasidic panic hits hard because there's a man, and my uncovered head, my nakedness before a man. I pause, I breathe, grit my teeth, and I tell myself, "You are really going to do this." Then I open the door, stand up in the Texas sun, and I step out in front of an actual man with my head uncovered. I stand and turn, resolute, take another breath, a step, another. Then I stop short because I have a sudden, enormous urge to stride over, reach up, grab that tall old cowboy by his frayed flannel collar, and say, "Do you know you're the first man besides my husband to see my hair in 25 years? Instead, I take in his sun-browned face and I burst out laughing. "How good is this?" I think. It's not that no one of consequence way out here, far from my community, will see my bare head. It's that no one cares. I continue walking, shaking my head and laughing at myself. I'm still chuckling as I pass him, as he blows out his cigarette smoke in a tight stream. Those squinting Texas eyes follow me. Weird city girl.
That's wonderful. I do love your humor. I how long did it take to write this book?
Well, ask me how many times I wrote it. Yeah. I probably threw out 5 books for what it got down to, and it took about 8 years.
Wow. Yeah, because I can see how the story matures, and you're able to add humor, see humor. Mm-hmm. Probably, you know, when it's fresh happening, you don't see all of that. But I do love that aspect of the way you tell stories, is there's a lot of compassion and humor, I think, that comes through. What do you hope that people take away from the book? Like, I mean, it's hard, you know. I know everyone wants something different, but do you have any specific hopes?
Oh, my deepest. I want what every writer wants. I want my book to jump from the specific to the universal, and I know that it can only do so if it's very, very specific. Mm-hmm. I did not set about to change the world or to inspire people. I set about to tell my story because it's the only thing I have authority to do.
Right.
But really, every single person walking on this earth says some aspect of themselves that's uncovered.
Yeah.
Right. And if one story of, you know, someone managing to do that speaks to them, I'm happy.
Right. Well, I think it absolutely does that. I mean, I think that it's a book that appeals to people, whether or not they know anything about the world you came from. I think it shows that kind of humanity that I so admire in you and I've seen in you, because we've known each other forever. So it's a very proud thing that I get to sit next to you and look at this book with this title, because I heard it talked about, and it really is, it's just so exciting to see a story being told. And that it's actually reaching people, to, you know, reaching so, so many people. I want to thank you for being with us. And also, I want to remind everyone that we not only are here every Thursday night, but Scooter is up next also with Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour. Oh. And we have a few more minutes before we transition into the next thing. And so I wanted to ask... as I was reading your book, you also mention a lot of poetry, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also a love of mine as well. And I'm wondering if you could just share with us that little teeny snippet about Adrienne Rich's poet. I don't know if you remember that poem.
Oh, very well. Do I have time? I think I have time.
Okay, good.
Instead of talking about it, I'm just going to read you that section.
Perfect.
Okay, so I have to give a quick intro, is that we didn't read secular books. We didn't have television in the house. We really believed that the internet was fairly irrelevant. It was there, but, you know, I didn't get on very much. And secular literature, it wasn't for women. It wasn't forbidden, but it was discouraged. And then they kind of look up the other way if women did read. Many of us did, because it was sort of like devalued literature for devalued people. Mm-hmm. I took advantage of the fact that I was a woman and to read. And when I started writing those stories at night and hiding them, it wasn't working. I thought my writing sucked, and it did. So I went to the library, and I actually went to poetry just because it was shorter.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have time.
Right, right.
So I had no clue what I was doing. And then one day I was out and stopped by a bookstore and dared to look, and I saw people browsing and without censors, so like I did too. Mm-hmm. And I saw one of the poets that I had seen before, and I didn't know what I was doing, so I came home with a volume of work by Adrienne Rich. So this story is on the Sabbath, when my kids are like spreading their toys all over the house, and I'm trying to supervise and falling asleep, and I try to study because we normally did, but I was waking up, and it sounded misogynist to me for the first time, so I decided that I would read something else. I launch out of my seat, the kids still playing, and return in no time with the first secular book I've ever bought as an adult by Adrienne Rich. And I already told you how, so I'll skip. It climbs into the recliner with me and puts his head in my lap. He was up at the Sabbath table, still needs his naps. Hoping he'll doze, I sit very still and stroke his shoulder until my own eyes grow heavy. Sleepy-eyed, I turn pages, pick out a few lines at a time, sometimes scanning new territory. The poetry begins to seep into a half-conscious place, like the slow, deep spread of spilled ink. She writes, the rules break like a thermometer. Quicksilver spills across the charted systems. Is that what I'm doing, I think? She writes, a woman's voice singing old songs, plucked and fingered by women outside the law. Singing old songs, even as women outside the law, like my Rosellen, my writer friend, pulling me away from the rules. The pile of blocks on the floor has grown. A rummy gets up to go get more. I point at the mound, my gaze on him. You can bring them if you clean them, I say. Do I have to stop?
Yeah, we got to stop soon. Finish that sentence for me, though.
Okay, it's six shifts on my lap. I think I'm going to have to do it.
Yeah.
Can I finish it? Or...
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I hate to cut us
I'm
off.
I'm sorry, but...
No, we could talk all day, but
well,
I guess my
listeners were going to have to find it.
They'll
and
have
read
to
the rest
the
of the scene for
exactly.
themselves.
And we're here again at 10, and we hope that you will stay with us for Scooters. He's up next. We hope you keep loving a great story and keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. I am Rabbi Laura Sheinkoff, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
This was fun.
Saturday, March 26th, come celebrate Spring Sounds with Night Sounds and our KPFT 90.1 FM benefit and silent auction with live music on stage. 14 bands at two great venues, Last Concert Cafe and Midtown Bar and Grill. A suggested donation of $10 gets you into both venues. All donations go to KPFT, Houston's community radio station. We'll be at Last Concert Cafe from 3 to 7 p.m. with live music from Dr. Belt, Starflight, The Footnotes, James Henry, and featuring Jeremy Smith. And at Midtown Bar and Grill. Grill the same day from 4 p.m. till 2 a.m. with Rain Flower, Don Noel, Emily Cole, Solo Dollars, Harold Schelling, Hype Electro, Idigenous, The Aspiring Me, Coffee Brothers Rum, and Lyric Michelle. Go to Night Sounds on Facebook for more details. Spend your Saturday with Night Sounds, March 26th from 3.